You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 5th of January 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and a very warm welcome to episode 234 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. It's been a merry Christmas break and the celebrations aren't over yet. For the final show of 2013, we're taking a festive look back at some of the highlights of the past year here at Midori House. Think of it as some sort of jam-packed radio sandwich after the main course, stuffed with hot topics rather than cold turkey and lavishly garnished with a number of poorly constructed metaphors. Sounds tasty to you, Andrew?
Sounds like a cracker, Rob.
Let's crack on then. There's plenty to come over the next hour, ranging from a chat with Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales.
I feel this very strong sense of responsibility that for whatever reason, I can say something and it's in the news about politics. I really enjoy sort of reminding politicians that the internet really matters and you can't just bumble around.
To Israeli filmmaker Dror Morey.
The politician, basically those leaders, the head of the Shin Bet answer only to one person, the prime minister, should have done much more than they did.
And of course, we'll be revisiting Andrew and I's essential masterclass on correct yodeling technique.
Hey!
Yeah, exactly.
Hey!
Yeah.
Hey!
Yeah.
Okay.
As well as seeing eye to eye with Monsters of the Deep.
That and much more are coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Normally at this point in the programme, we talk about what we're looking forward to, what's happened this week. We've got a whole year to look back on. How long do you think it's going to take us?
Okay, well, on January the 1st, what happened was...
I've got
my diary here.
Have you?
I can turn all the pages. We can find out what happened I did on each day.
So I just quiz you really briefly. What did you have for dinner on July the 6th?
Bagel. Just a bagel, nothing in it.
Wow.
I'm not very good at this quick on the draw thing.
Was it the day before payday? Just had a tin of mushroom soup and some toast.
It's quite hard to remember this whole year.
It's very hard to remember it.
We published a book.
I know that's illustrative of what a nutty year it's been. It's been all. Yeah. It's been noses to the grindstone. That is a grindstone. That you know where my nose has been close to. That's a grindstone.
I thought it looked a bit sore. Yes. Yeah, so we published a book. We opened a cafe in London.
Yeah.
We went.
We did 12 issues of Monocle. We did two issues of a newspaper.
10 issues of Monocle. I'm not sure what the other two that you were working on. They were doubles, mate. They minor double. You lost two there.
It's my Freudian numbering system.
Yes, yeah, so I don't
how
think
many it feels it's been.
We opened Toronto this year, the bureau. When we opened Istanbul.
Yeah.
Wow, it's been a busy 12 months.
I think we opened Toronto. Rob Ford can close it. Just shut it down. We opened it. We did our best. Just shut it down now, right?
It has been a very busy and we relaunched the website. We kind of relaunched it last year, but actually this year it became good.
We hoiked the bottle of champagne against the hull of monocle.com, didn't we, again this year?
Yes. Yes.
And you've still got your sleeves rolled up. What more do we need to do, Andrew? Put the just come on, turn them down, put a jumper on.
Now hold on. I do like to roll a sleeve up. Take my watch off when I sit at my desk. But you're kind of a jumpers on man.
Well, I am. As soon as it stops being warm, as soon as it stops being summer, I'm basically freezing until May. I don't know what happens.
The person who confuses me is Daniel Giacopelli, who's one of our producers, who comes to work in a jacket and a nice tie and a shirt and a jumper, many layers, doesn't take any of them off, just sits there very neatly. I kind of imagine him on a beach holiday with a jacket on.
He's like a very small American footballer.
Yes. Anyway, Rob, we've got a whole year to get through here.
We have indeed. Well, what a year it's been. We've given our weekly news savant, Tom Edwards, the week off. So with no further ado, let's look back to January 2013, when we welcomed theatre critic and writer Henry Hitchings into Studio One. Henry came to tell us about Sorry, the English and Their Manners, which looks at how behaviour is not just the measure of your immediate surroundings, but also the history of a place too. And we join Andrew and Henry talking about use of Mr., Mrs. and everything in between.
It's something that springs up between the wars, but it's really more in the sort of 50s and 60s when you get into things like open plan offices and the whole kind of cult of informality in the workplace in particular that this really sort of develops. I think One point to make is that because Britain is now a lot more multicultural, there are people coming from different traditions where honorific names, you know, monsieur and herr this, and, you know, cultures where I don't even know what the relevant words are, they're coming here. And sir and madam feel like quite good things to default to, because certainly if you come here from elsewhere, you're aware that there are all these names and titles and honorifics, and you don't want to get it wrong. But with sir and madam, you're quite safe. And I think maybe also that the issue about when you use someone's given name is a little bit of a blurry issue. But nobody ever minds the Mr. Tuck approach.
And tell me, one of the stories I really love is the kind of the arrival of the fork and kind of what this meant for kind of table manners. And there's a very nice description of being somebody being in Italy, I think in the 1600s, and they see somebody using a fork as rather than a kind of jabbing instrument, you know, as a personal fork for the first time. And it was this idea that actually you needed to have, people didn't want their dirty hands all over their food.
Yes, it was a traveller called Thomas Coriat, and he was in Italy in 1608, and he saw people using forks individually, discreetly, rather than having a single fork on the table for hoiking things from a communal dish. And he brought a fork back to England and was ridiculed for using it. What he identified as a particular advantage of the fork was you could eat berries without staining your fingers. So that's maybe not something we think of now, but the process of sort of evolution of table manners has been about making the sort of touching of food more remote from us, and it becomes a more specialised thing. So, for example, at a medieval feast, a lot of the cooking of the food and the preparation of the food would have happened in your presence, but there's a move then in the sort of Renaissance towards the preparation happening elsewhere. It becomes more of a sort of specialised activity, and you also get specialisation in domestic architecture, so that the hall and the place that you dine and the place that the cooking gets done are separated. And that's a sort of move that continues. In the history of domestic architecture, it's quite interesting, the specialisation of spaces and houses. But of course now the average person in Britain lives in a tiddly little place and doesn't have that specialisation, so things evolve.
And do you think in a city like London, where we have people drawn from all over the world, we're likely to be offended more often, not because people from around the world have worse table manners than us, but I think you point out in the book, you know, that there are certain things, you know, for example, Japanese people, they like to slurp, and that the slurping is an indication that the food is good, and that actually for a Western ear, that's a little bit intolerable.
I think the thing is that to live in a city like London, you need to sort of develop almost a shield of cold indifference that you carry through life. And it's not rudeness, it's actually just a way of making life manageable, because you're being assaulted by stimuli the whole time in a big city. And, you know, there would be a kind of psychological and emotional overload if you actually responded to all those things. So you instead have this sort of veneer of froideur, and you carry that through life. And that means, I think, that we do tolerate people who do things a bit strangely. It was just this understanding that London benefits from being a melting pot, and sometimes unsightly things are the kind of, you know, the flip side of that.
And you talk about this idea, as we mentioned at the start of this conversation, about England being associated with manners. Do you think that the other countries around the world look at the English and think we are quite mannered?
I think they do. I think they also think, it's this point that I was making, they think that we're obsessed with manners. They don't necessarily think we're terribly polite, but they think that we agitate about manners. I mean, it's very noticeable, some of the sort of guides that we have. You know, you still have things like Debrett's Guide to Correct Form. And actually, when I travel abroad, manuals like that tend to be less widely available, and certainly less respected.
And how much do you think these days manners is also about class? Because certainly reading back through your book, many of the instances where you see, you know, very sharply defined manners, they're connected to kind of wealth or prosperity, but they seem to be as much about kind of behaving well as about keeping other people out, in a way, the people with manners and the people without manners.
That's very true. We use manners as a kind of social filter. And again, one of the sort of great periods of flux in this is the Victorian period, because it was a period of much greater social mobility, and it became rather harder to work people's class out from other distinguishing features. So manners were used almost as a sort of mechanism for discriminating between people. And if you were a socially aspirational person, you then cultivated manners and indeed etiquette, which seemed like a kind of symptom of something underlying, in order to project a positive image of yourself.
That was Andrew talking to theatre critic and writer Henry Hitchings way back in January. Where next, Andrew?
Well, I'd like to spin the factual globe and stick a random pin in it on the man who founded one of the great time-wasting devices of our time, Wikipedia. Depending on your view, Jimmy Wales is online and constantly evolving, if not entirely factually guaranteed, encyclopedia is a resource that has transformed people's ability to gain immediate base-level knowledge on almost any subject. It's the sixth most popular site in the world, according to, well, Wikipedia. Jimmy Wales joined Monocle's Steve Bloomfield back in August to explain why he's made London his new home and what the tech scene here has to offer.
The tech industry here is growing rapidly. There's a cool scene with lots of cool stuff going on. But the fact that it's not Silicon Valley, I think, is to its advantage, really. I don't think there's anybody who really thinks, gosh, if only I could live in San Jose, because it's not that great. Whereas in London, you do get this amazing intellectual cross-fertilization, the kinds of different people you can meet and work with who you would never find in Silicon Valley is pretty amazing.
And talk about the sort of work that you do now. A lot of what you're doing seems to be, in a way, quite political. It's activism in a way. It's about saying, you know, it's about opening things up rather than, you know, what's the new thing that's going to make me a huge amount of money.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I, for better or worse, I don't really care that much about money. I have a very nice life. So, and I feel this very strong sense of responsibility that for whatever reason, I can say something and it's in the news about politics. And so I can bring issues to the forefront that might not otherwise come to the forefront in at least some small way. And so that's something that I really enjoy doing. I really enjoy sort of reminding politicians that the internet really matters and you can't just bumble around. It's something I enjoy doing.
On that issue of the internet really matters, you can't just bumble around. You know, you've been doing some work here with the UK government. This government doesn't always strike me as the sort of government that really understands how the internet works. Is that fair?
Yeah, but I think that's true of all governments. And there are some really great people in the UK government and some really horrible people in the UK government relating to the internet. And, you know, this is a coalition government, but even more than that, I think it's Cameron, for better or worse, it truly is a cabinet government. It doesn't all flow top down from Cameron. But what that means is there's completely radical disconnect between different parts of the government. Some parts are very keen on technology and so forth. Others are just, I mean, would roll back the clock 15 years if they could in favor of copyright lobby and so on. So it's really, it's a mixed bag. But I think that's true basically everywhere. You know, you'll have different politicians who have different levels of understanding, or in the U.S., different levels of being paid off by relevant interests. So, yeah, it makes for an interesting environment, because just when you think, ah, oh, this is really great. I mean, the government really is doing just a fabulous job. And then you open the newspaper the next day and you see the latest boneheaded idea that they've put forward. So then what do?
Where does your activism come from? Because it's, you know, to look at your career, it doesn't, correct me if I'm wrong, but you weren't on big student protests when you were younger. That I don't get the sense that there was a sort of big idealistic young teenage Jimmy Wales who wanted to change the world.
No, there always was. And it's actually one thing that's quite interesting is that I come from, and we in the world of Wikipedia, we come from the free software movement, open source software, which has always been quite political in a small p political sense, political about issues of openness and freedom and making rational decisions and so forth. And that grows, of course, out of a deeper kind of geek culture, sort of the culture of Star Trek, you know, the sort of a rational universe with hopefully thoughtful decision making and a little bit of boldness. And that kind of culture for a long time was just within the computer industry, right? And it didn't really matter for everybody else that programmers were banging on about the importance of sharing code and so forth. But now that everybody's using the internet, issues of copyright, for example, impact all of us. In the old days, if you took a little film of your kid's birthday party, a little movie, and you sent it to grandma, you wouldn't have any, it would never occur to you to think about what's the copyright law for the music that was playing in the background. Now you make that same film and you make it for grandma and you put a little soundtrack on it. And you go, this is so cute, we'll send it to grandma. And YouTube detects the soundtrack and silences your movie. And you think, well, I'm not a pirate. I'm just somebody trying to make a kid's birthday party movie. You know, it's a bit bonkers. And there's a million ways that this kind of thing impacts people. All the kinds of things that people are trying to do online. Suddenly, what we've been talking about for a long time about openness and taking cognizance of the impact of these technologies on our lives, which are not only just the simple things of like, oh, well, now I can look up a restaurant on my phone, but all the different things about who I can communicate with. These days, of course, who's tracking me? Who's watching me? How do we deal with those kinds of issues? So suddenly issues that used to be political only within the computer science world are now impacting everybody.
And that was Steve Bloomfield talking to Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales back in August 2013. And you're tuned in to the best of the Monocle Weekly. We'll be right back after this.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Don't know about you, Andrew, but I consumed enough glühwein this Christmas to keep a small alpine village in merry song until the first green shoots of edelweiss come peeking through the thawing spring snow.
It's funny you should mention alpine traditions, Rob, as we're headed that way next. Back in March, we were paid a visit by Doreen Kutzka, or Kutzkalina as she's known. Kutzkalina is an urban yodeler, combining the traditional voice of the mountains with dub and electronica to breathe new life into the art. And she doesn't just perform it, she's been teaching the residents of Berlin too. She dropped in to give Rob and I a lesson. But first, here's her take on Bob Dylan's You Ain't Going Nowhere.
Clouds so swift, rain won't lift, gate won't close, railings froze. Get your mind off winter time, you ain't going nowhere. Ooh wee, ride me high, tomorrow's the day my man's gonna come. Whoa, ho, we're gonna fly down in the easy chair. I don't care how many letters they send, morning came and morning went. Pick up your money and pack up your chant, you ain't go nowhere. Ooh wee, ride me high, tomorrow's the day my man's gonna come. Whoa, we're gonna fly down in the easy chair.
Oh,
Kutz Kalina, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
That sounded absolutely amazing. We'd had a little mess around on SoundCloud and YouTube and the like to kind of fix an idea in our heads of what it sounded like, but it sounds quite amazing live, doesn't it, Andrew?
Incredible. It's one of those funny things when you're sitting next to somebody who has that much amount of energy coming out. It makes you quiver almost. It's quite exciting sitting next to you. Amazing.
Power voice.
Yeah, right. It warms up no end.
Yodeling is always just something really powerful. And yeah, maybe you can just fear people with yodeling, I think.
Now, first of all, Andrew's kind of rolling his eyes at me.
Because he knows I've got the word.
Okay, I've got to do a bit of a cough first. Because I'm. Andrew, do you want to start?
I'm not even sure where my chest voice is, actually. But I can
chest voice.
This is your chest voice.
Okay, this is my chest voice.
So you have to focus your chest voice into a really, it's really like shouting. So maybe go one step.
Okay.
Hey!
Yeah, exactly.
Hey!
Yeah.
Hey!
Yeah.
Okay. That's good.
Hey!
You're really close.
And longer. Hey!
And not longer.
I might get a taxi in a minute, I think.
And try to hold it a little bit longer, like, hey!
Hey!
This is great.
Super. And now, this is the first part of yodeling, so it was just a half yodel. Now, you know your falsetto voice, where it is a head voice. It's ee! Ooh!
Here it goes.
Yeah.
Ee! Ooh!
Excellent. Brilliant.
You'll get a whale rather than a taxi, don't you?
And really, yodeling is very close to laughing, so it's the same energy. You will feel better.
Okay. I'm coming to Kreuzberg. Now,
connect those voices like, hey!
I'm in the wrong place. Let's try again. Yeah. Give me it one more time.
Yeah. Okay,
here goes. I think I need more lessons.
Okay. You have to start on the chest first. Okay. Try first the chest again once again.
I think you're very good because this is the first time you've ever yodeled. Other than that other time, which we don't try.
So the chest is like here.
Hey!
Hey! Okay.
Hey!
Hey! Yeah. And I'm starting here, then going up.
Yeah.
Hold on, everyone.
This is excellent.
I think you're safe in your job.
And that was Andrew and I getting a primer on how to yodel back in March 2013. You're listening to the best of the Monocle Weekly. We'll be revisiting a chat with filmmaker Dror Morey in a moment, whose controversial documentary, The Gatekeepers, was one of the film events of the year. In the first part of 2013, we were lucky enough to be joined on the Monocle Weekly by Dror Morey, an Israeli filmmaker whose documentary film, The Gatekeepers, tells the story of Shin Bet, his nation's internal security service.
Morey's film unfolds through a series of cool interviews with six men who ran the organisation. As they sit and tell their stories, you hear about the decisions they made in often brutal detail. You glimpse the moments when the chances for peace in the Middle East slipped away. And you see men who know they did what they believed was right to defend their nation, but who also seem troubled by where they have now found themselves.
Amongst the acclaim for the film, some at the heart of the Israeli establishment believe that Morey has betrayed his country. Back in April, he joined Andrew in the studio to talk about the highly charged topic.
Shin Bet is the intelligence agency. Basically, in Israel, there are three intelligence agencies. The Mossad was responsible for outside of Israel. I would compare it to the CIA. The military intelligence, which does everything, and the Shin Bet, who is normally, or his main function is to cover the inside territories, inside Israel and the occupied territories. He is a kind of a combination between CIA and FBI. He is responsible for also the targeted assassination. Basically, it's an intel organization, very clandestine in the Israel, and it's a very, very important. The people who are working there are the specialists on, I would say, the war on terror, and about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This is their main issue.
Now, the film goes to meet the people who have run this organization over the years, and it has an arc that goes back to 1967. And the film works in lots of different levels. So it's a history of the region and of contemporary Israel. But it's the story of these men who ran this organization. Can you explain to me how come, when you went and knocked on their doors, they agreed to tell their stories? Because they sit talking to camera. The story that unfolds is one that kind of terrifying, at times a story of bravery, at times a story of when their humanity slipped away from them. It's an incredible film to watch. How come they told you these stories?
Look, I think that the timing for me to approach them was really good for them, because they feel that for a long, long time, the country, the Israel policy, especially the policymakers, are doing the wrong thing, and they're not putting their most efforts in trying to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And they feel that this is the most important issue that Israel should deal with. And I think that this is why the primary reason why they came to speak so openly and candidly. By the way, all of them, all the head of the Shin Bet, of the secret organization, came and spoke openly for the first time. Until 1995, we were not allowed, even the Israeli public were not allowed to know their names and the public figure. They were just called by their initials. Only after the assassination of Rabin, the only person from the Shin Bet who is allowed to be known is the head of the Shin Bet. And all of them came to this film because they felt urgency to tell their message, because they were there on the ground dealing with all those things that you talked about, maintaining the security of Israel. And they feel now that it didn't lead Israel into a better political reality.
Now, there's lots of things I want to quiz you on, but before we move on, can I just ask you, is there a sense that these are men all of a certain age, and they sit there looking, you know, something like your grandfather, and then they begin to tell these stories of events that they've been involved in? Do you think there's a little bit, just pulling the story away from the political to the personal, is there a little bit of these people looking back over their lives and thinking they've done lots of things to protect the state of Israel, but my God, you know, where have we ended up? And they kind of want some solution, some resolution for themselves, maybe as well.
Well, some of them are younger, you know. Some of them are 55. It varies from 55 to 85, because all of them came to speak. If there is something that I can say that they share in common, is they are pragmatists. They understand the limitation of power, and when they see Israel today, which they fought so hard in order to preserve, in order to maintain the security of the state of Israel, they understand that in all their efforts went in vain. They didn't bring Israel into a better place. On the contrary, they feel that the more Israel is moving on in the course of time, it's less and less safer. And the politician, basically those leaders, the head of the Shin Bet, answer only to one person: the prime minister should have done much more than they did.
I think that's one of the extraordinary things that comes out of this film, is that you would imagine that within the state of Israel, that the security services and the politicians, because they've all served in the army, they have a kind of shared history, a shared ambition, that their blood would flow through the same veins. But in fact, when these people from Shin Bet talk, you see they have a weariness of politicians and a feeling that in the end, the politician will always let you down. Was that something that you felt came across in the making of this film?
Yeah, if there is something that was shocking and riveting to me as an Israeli, because I'm a product of the educational system of Israel, where you were always taught that Israel is always striving for peace, that Israel always seeks for peace, and that the Israeli leaders always did their utmost in order to reach peace. And when you hear from those people, from the head of the Shin Bet, who work very, very closely to the prime ministers of Israel all through the years, when they say how much missed opportunities were there by the prime minister of Israel, not only by the Palestinians. By the way, the Palestinians have their share of guilt in the situation that we are in, but to understand that the Israeli prime minister, the leaders of Israel, also didn't really want to move forward and really did it honestly. They spoke about peace, but didn't really had the courage to go into the methods, into the terms of that needs to move forward in order to reach peace. And this is something that is devastating for me as an Israeli, because I think that the most crucial problem of Israel is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It shares and sheds shadows all over the region. And Israel, it's in the best interest, and it's not me only. This is what the gatekeepers, the head of the Shin Bet, are saying, that this is in the best interest of Israel to reach two-state solution.
And that was Andrew talking to Israeli filmmaker Dror Morey on The Monocle Weekly. I feel like a bit of music now, Andrew. However, I dropped my iPod in a pint of eggnog over the holidays, and all I seem to have here at the M24 studio is a dusty pile of old records from Vienna, of all places.
They'll be back from in June, Rob. Do you remember? Viennese music aficionado Florian Obkircher came in to talk to you and Hugo MacDonald about some lost pop classics from a strangely overlooked scene. Shall we have a listen?
The history of Viennese pop music goes back to the 50s. Actually, that's not quite true, because in the 50s, there was no such thing as the pop scene in Vienna, because Vienna in the 50s, it was very Catholic, conservative ground for young bands. I mean, there were young rock and roll bands from abroad playing, but there was no scene. Like the first steps into this ground were done by comedians, actually, who adapted the new formats of rock and roll, but turned it into like ironic songs that kind of like took the edge away.
Like
the
musical environment, yeah.
Exactly. It took a while, and whereas other countries, Elvis Presley and all of these, they already had their rock and roll icons, it took until the 60s, until the first, I would say, original beat band hit the city. It was The Slaves, and they were the first Viennese band to write their own songs. I wouldn't say that they have an original sound, because back then it was all about getting as close to the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, yeah. the international heroes.
But we're going to play a bit of that, Florian, and then we can riff on that a bit later. And when Tom, our producer for this show, played me this record, it sounds to me like Off the Hook, one of the early Stone singles from 66, 65, 66, something. But this is The Slaves with Slave Time. Slave Time by The Slaves, and it does sound like the Stones doing Chuck Berry, and it's an Austrian band doing the Stones doing Chuck Berry, I guess, isn't it? That's an amazing thing. No one listening to that could possibly have guessed, unless they knew this band, that they were an Austrian band.
That's true. I mean, at the time they came out, it was around 67. They only sold their 7 inches at their gigs, but it had no impact on the whole country. It was not played on the radio. And the consequence was that rock and roll and the whole beat scene arrived years later in Austria, where in Italy you would also already have your scene, like in France. It took long in Austria because the Slaves kind of, I don't know why, but they did.
The Slaves took a while to break free.
Yeah, they never really did. Actually, if you want to buy one of their 3 7-inches today, on the internet, you'd probably pay a few hundred pounds.
Oh, Florian, you mentioned the radio there and the fact that the Slaves weren't being played on the radio. But what was being played on the radio at that time?
Well, the first for pop culture relevant radio station started in, I think, 68. That was Ö3, part of the Austrian national broadcaster.
Yeah,
exactly. But what they were after was music that had that sound of like the international recordings, but kind of mingled it with Austrian, especially Austrian, not saying German, Austrian lyrics. So you'd have someone like Wolfgang Ambros, who kind of took like these psychedelic sounds and wrote this amazing anthem called Der Hofer, which is a song about some people find a dead body. To break it down, it's like very Austrian stories that they combined with either psychedelic rock. Marianne Mendt is another example. She had like this easy listening thing going on.
She's a bit of a Marianne Faithful. She's except better looking, to be honest. She looks great. Marianne Mendt. There's an album cover of her called Wir Glocken.
Exactly. That's considered the first Austropop.
Austropop
hit. Yeah.
I'm writing all this down, you realise. I love the sound. I love the look of these. I think I'm going to love the sound of these records because I love the album covers. These are real channeling the 60s, aren't they?
And let me tell you, you would love it, actually. Yeah. Also the sound. Like some of these songs, you mentioned it before, musically it might not be that outstanding, but as a whole, it's really unique.
So it's kind of a scene made on a vibe then. You know, it was a thing about it was almost like covers with the soul of the music rather than the words, and rather than copying Stones and Beatles and Beach Boys tracks, it was more about kind of picking up the vibe. But let me ask you one thing. What happens now? Is it a club culture? Because we're going to pull people into 2013 here, Flo, very briefly, because we're going to probably stagger around and go back to one of everyone's favourites from Austria, Falco.
Farkle.
Yeah,
sure.
We've got that because we've been watching that. We've been watching that on YouTube this morning to do our research, and that's amazing. But what happens now? Because there's a very big club culture. There's obviously places where indie bands play, and there's all the rest of it. There's a strong radio. There's radio stations. There's a strong scene for that. But there's a lot of clubbing going on, right?
Yes. I think after a few years of stagnation, Vienna in particular really caught up with the international club scene through new acts like August Debris, for example, Electro Guzzi. I'm pretty sure I'm forgetting the most important ones right here, but it's interesting. I remember when I moved to Vienna, that was around 2000, there was actually one good club you could go to where new music was played. These days, countless, like it's at least five, and they just opened within the last three or four years.
And what's the scene like? Is it quite scene-y? Is it kind of tribal? Are people, you're into this, so you go to this place, you're into that, you go to the other place. Mm. There's kind of less of that in London than there used to be a lot of it, isn't there, Hugo? I mean, it's kind of, exactly. Everyone is everywhere and every place will play pretty much every sort of music. But what about Vienna? Is it kind of delineated into its neighbourhoods, into its tribes?
I think Vienna, at the moment, Vienna is Berlin's little brother in a way. Yeah. So, of course, yes, you'd hear a lot of techno, you'd hear a lot of house. I mean, it kind of like follows international trends, obviously. And at the moment, like the whole UK bass scene is big there as well.
So it's a big mixture. Should we listen to another track?
We're going to listen to a track. And we are going to, as promised, I wanted to kind of save it to last, but we're going to play Falco and Der Kommissar. Check it out, Joe.
And that was Florian Obkircher, co-author of the book Vienne Pop, which looks at the history of pop music in Vienna.
You're tuned in to the best of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We'll be having a whale of a time with ocean-obsessed author Philip Hoare after this.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If we're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu. Every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
In June, a few of us were beginning to hit the beach, including Andrew, who wasn't here when author, broadcaster and holder of curious maritime titles such as Artist in Residence at the Marine Institute of Plymouth University, Philip Hoare, came to visit.
His book, The Sea Inside, tells an anecdotal journey that aims to reconnect people with the mysteries of the sea, starting on the south coast of the UK and taking in the Azores, Sri Lanka and New Zealand en route. He joined Rob and Steve Bloomfield, who began by asking if there's anything to fear in the briny blue deep.
Throughout the book, I end up in various oceans with various animals, yeah. ranging from small little Hector's dolphins in New Zealand to blue whales in Sri Lanka. But yeah, I mean, you know, you do well to fear the sea. I was swimming in November last year off Brighton and I was turned 360 degrees head over heels and momentarily lost consciousness. And in that moment, I thought how banal to die within sight of a Starbucks and a dual carriageway.
And there's a quote that you start one of the chapters in the book, there's your quote from Walter de la Mer, who yeah. we talked saying before we turned the microphones on, yeah. is a very serendipitous name to have, Walter yeah. de la Mer,
yeah.
who says a similar sort of thing, that yeah. it's almost an honour to be swallowed by the sea.
Absolutely. I grew up in a port. I grew up in Southampton on the south coast of the UK. And I was, you know, I was scared of the sea. I was scared of what lay in it. I was scared of what it would do to me. It was only when I came to live in London, I was writing for various magazines and things in the 1980s, and I taught myself to swim in a really rank Victorian public swimming pool in Hackney, you know, sort of yeah. really far from yeah. the sea, because I felt that the water was a challenge to me. I felt that I was allowing this notional element to beat me, the notion, you know, and I wanted to challenge that. And ever since then, I have to swim every day. I mean, this morning, I swim every day in the sea off Southampton, but this morning the tide was low, so I had to swim in the Serpentine this morning.
You talk about how we don't really know the sea. The sea we know is these so-called resorts. It's at the coast, and we just see it, you know, lapping up on the shore. That's the relationship that most of us have with the sea. How did yours change, develop during the course of writing this book?
Well, I suppose because, I mean, literally it's a very long journey. It's from Southampton via the English Channel to the Azores to Sri Lanka to Tasmania and then the Banks Peninsula off the east coast of New Zealand, progressively getting in sort of deeper and stranger waters. And its denizens, the animals that live there. And I don't know about you, but when I was a boy, and even now, I'm scared of what the creatures below, you know, even in quite shallow water, you know, the notion of seaweed and
it's
things.
When something touches your ankle when you're swimming, and you always wonder whether it's a dorsal fin.
Exactly.
And this is a thing. This is a thing. This is a fear, presumably. You know, sailors couldn't swim famously, could they? And probably until the turn of the 20th century at the very earliest.
And many sailors still don't swim. Because it's superstitious.
And also, actually, one of the reasons sailors and fishermen didn't learn to swim is because if you fell overboard in the middle of the Atlantic, there ain't no
hope for
you. You just die slower if you learn to swim, basically. So there was no point there, you know. So all those things go through your head if you are like me, you know, in the waters off the Azores, which are 3 miles deep. These are just drowned volcanoes, infested with the most magnificent predator known to human beings and nature as a whole, which is the sperm whale, which is the biggest predator that's ever lived, bigger than any dinosaur as a predator. And I've had sperm whales come swim straight up to me. And that's a really scary thing because they're the only whale that, should it choose to, if it opened its mouth, it could swallow you. And no other whale could do that.
These are carnivorous whales. These aren't whales with baleen. Filtering baleen. No. These have got gnashes. The squid and the whale is a sperm whale.
That's right. Yeah. They eat giant squid whole. Mm. So, you know, when you come into a contact with...
So they don't go, is that the well-regarded writer, Philip Hall?
No,
I'll spit him out.
No,
they just go for it.
No. what happens is you feel, you don't hear, you feel their echolocation going through the whole of your skeleton, creating a three-dimensional image, like a computer-generated image almost, like a CGI image or a scanner in their head. That bounces straight back through their head and into their brain. So they read you and they know exactly what you are, whether or not you're edible or not. So they can tell if a woman's pregnant or not, actually. It's incredibly accurate sonar. And then, but the thing about sperm whales, although they are these ferocious beasts of Moby Dick fame, they are incredibly placid and actually quite timid. They're scared of dolphin. And so, you know, they're very kind of like checking you out, really. And of course, they also have the biggest brain of any animal on the planet. And that brain's working. You see that in the eye of a sperm whale, when it looks you eye to eye, there's sentience there. They are reading you. It's not the eye of a cow or a dog or a horse.
Frankly, I'm frankly terrified by the terrifying idea that you can look a sperm whale in the whale in the eye. These are humongous beasts.
It's the first time I lost control of my bodily functions since I was about six.
Okay. Phew. That's let out some squid ink.
And then I got really worried because I thought, you know, they say if you pee in the water with sharks around, they get agitated and go for you more. And also then I thought, how bloody rude, you know, peeing in the water in someone's house, you know, which is, you know, this is where the whales live, so.
But the sperm whale was okay.
Absolutely fine. Looked at me, eye to eye. I was as close as you are to me now. And then it just looked and dove right down from the blue into the, and this is kind of amazing Eve Klein blue, into this profound black, and just disappeared. I remember laughing to myself because it really looked like a kind of cartoon version of a whale, you know, that kind of cartoon whale that you drew when you were a kid with big square head and whatever, you know. And it was just,
and he's on the cover,
unreal.
There's a blue whale at the top, and there's a sperm whale there.
Exactly so.
That was Rob and Steve Bloomfield talking to author and broadcaster Philip Hoare.
Now we're almost at the end of our Best of 2013 episode, Andrew. 2014 awaits, and judging by the standard of the past 52 weeks, it's going to be a vintage year.
Let's hope so. Our penultimate clip today is a chat with US novelist and short story writer Ben Fountain a master of turning the everyday into prize-winning prose. His books, Brief Encounters with Che Guevara and Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, have been recipients of the Penn Hemingway Award for Short Stories and the National Book Critics Circle Award, two of the highest honours for writing in the US.
But success isn't always straightforward. Fountain studied law before finding his calling as a fiction writer. And his contemplative, reflective chat in May 2013 was a reminder to us all about how to give creativity the time and space it needs to breathe and hopefully flourish. Here's Ben talking to Andrew and Steve.
I think part of it is it just takes me a while to figure things out. And I wish I was smarter. But apparently I'm not as smart as I wish I was. And also I was doing it largely on my own. I didn't get a master's in fine arts and writing. I didn't have a writing group. Sometimes I wonder if I would have developed faster if I'd been in a community, the right kind of community, writers or readers who are smart and open-minded, of generous spirit. But basically everything I learned on my own or from the reading I did.
But do you feel you would have, if you had done that, you would have turned into a different kind of writer?
That's the question. And so you wonder if all those false paths you went down, if they were necessary steps in ultimately getting to where you get to. So I don't worry about it. It is what it is. You know, I just, every day I get up and try to get the words on the page.
Now, we'll talk about Billy Lynn in a moment, but your first huge success was a book of short stories which are based on real, well, which are true stories. So how did this journey come to then again switch over from fact to fiction? Did your publisher say to you, you know, you've had with Brief Encounters with Che Guevara a huge success, but now I need a novel from you. This is the next step in your career. And was that something, or was it something you felt, actually, I'm now ready for this challenge?
Well, you know, I'll confess right here that I have two or three novels in the drawer that never saw the light of day, and it's that's fine. But I really wanted to write a novel and get a novel published, a novel that I was happy with. And I don't think I would have been satisfied with, you know, my writing career, if a career is what you want to call it, if I hadn't done this, written a novel that I was pleased with and got published. So it was me. I mean, it's not anything coming from the outside. This whole writing project has been really from the inside out.
You say you're fine with the fact that you have two or three novels in a drawer. Are you really? I mean, do you? Because it's one of the things about writing is people say, lots of writers say, well, I write for myself first and foremost, and that's what's most important. And if anyone else likes it, then that's just a bonus. But surely you're writing because you feel you have something to say and you want other people to hear it.
Right. When I say I'm fine with those novels in the drawer, you're right. Actually, I'm not. but I'm okay with the fact that they didn't get published because they simply weren't good enough. That's an interesting issue you bring up. I think on one level, you do have to write for yourself. You have to please yourself. I think part of the job is getting published. That's part of the writer's job. And Ezra Pound once made the comparison to a scout. Okay, there's a tribe. The tribe sends a scout out to, you know, reconnoiter the territory. And the scout sees what he sees and comes back and reports to the tribe. And he said that's what writers do. They go out, they survey the human condition, they come back to the tribe and report. And I think that's a pretty good analogy to what writers, most writers, are doing.
Now let's dip into the new book, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which is a story which looks at what happens to a group of soldiers returning to the US from Iraq, and especially to the main character, to Billy. When you began writing this book, were you concerned to tell the stories of soldiers? Was it a critique of war? Because what seems to be at the heart of a lot of it is actually a very kind of uncomfortable relationship between the American public, who on the one hand do lionize these men and have huge faith in them, and the rather different story for the people coming home and how they try to navigate their way back into this this world that seems suddenly a little bit alien.
I'm sure what I wanted to explore in this book, and it began as a very vague thing, but the tremendous disconnect between the reality of the war as it's experienced by the young men and women who fight it, and the reality of the war as it's perceived by mainstream American culture, which is basically a fantasy. And that's what I wanted to explore, this huge gap and why the war was perceived in such, to me, a false and misleading way in the United States, when I think it didn't take much awareness or curiosity to discover that much of the mainstream narrative that we were being given in those years was completely false.
That was Andrew and Steve Bloomfield talking to author Ben Fountain. Well, here we are at the end of 2013. We hope you've enjoyed our look back at the past 52 episodes of The Monocle Weekly, and we hope you'll join us for a few more in the coming year.
Well, Happy New Year, mate.
And to you, Andrew. I'm going to be in Bonnie, Scotland, actually, for New Year. Aye.
Oh, that's the other end of the country to where you normally are.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Sometimes it's Sussex. Sometimes it's Switzerland. This year we're going north.
It'll be chilly, at least.
It'll be, exactly.
And talking about chilly.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to help me with the next link. Ooh, you've helped me there.
I like this.
Chilly Gonzalez. He's a gentleman who's been on two best ofs in the past couple of years. Well, we've only had a couple of them. He's almost Monocle Weekly's house band. And we're going to play out with a contribution from him.
Because we might be marking the end of another good year, but we also hit the not inconsiderable landmark of 200 shows a few months back too. And Chilly Gonzalez was good enough to set that to music in his own distinct way. We'll leave it to the man himself to explain a little more. In the meantime, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Happy New Year.
Hello, this is Chilly Gonzalez, the musical genius. And I'm here to celebrate the 200th edition of the Monocle Weekly. Tyler, Andrew, and Rob, this is for you. Now, unfortunately, I don't do major keys because for me, they're outdated and represent a fantasy that doesn't exist. And so I only play music in a minor key. Now, Happy Birthday is a somewhat major song. It's a happy song. Yes, it's celebratory. And so my version may seem a bit darker, but you know, these milestones are hard earned. And I think my version represents that. Let's keep working for 200 more.